Welcome to a special bonus episode of Unpacking the Real. If you've spent time with us before, you'll know that this is a space where we think about questions raised by the Hollywood diary that exiled philosopher Gunther Anders wrote about his experiences working in a costume factory in 1941. The diary challenges our ideas about real and fake, and it frequently compares the Hollywood costume factory he worked in to a museum. This bonus episode exists because we couldn't resist the temptation to invite two experts in museum studies and history to react to the perspectives and questions it raises. My name is Helen Wolfenden, and in this conversation, you'll hear my podcast colleagues Ben Nicol and Chris Muller in conversation with two fascinating guests. Alina Kozlovsky is a lecturer in digital innovation, ancient history, and archaeology at the University of New England. She has a background in Roman archaeology and Roman history, and she's worked in museums in the UK and US. Our other esteemed guest for this conversation is Avril Alba. Avril is an associate professor in the Department of Hebrew, Biblical and Jewish Studies at the University of Sydney, and a longtime consultant for the Sydney Jewish Museum. Avril begins our conversation. We wanted to know what interested her about Gunther Anders' diary, Real is Not Real Enough.
My interest was sparked by not knowing much about Anders himself, and I really enjoyed learning more about him and about his journey as a German Jewish refugee, really, to Hollywood and what he made of his life there. But how, I think what was most fascinating for me is how he connects this really quite absurd work that he does. You know, here he is, this philosopher, this, you know, highly educated guy, and then he's undertaking this kind of absurd work with these costumes, and yet he's able to make meaning from it. And I think that's what really sort of struck me about the diary, is that it is really meaningful. When oftentimes when we think about Hollywood and we think of the idea of fakes, and he's really working with what I guess we would call fakes most of the time, and yet he is able to make that very meaningful, very poignant at times, you know. And the disjuncture that he experiences, I think, of knowing, in a sense, the disaster that's unfolding in Europe, and there he is surrounded by frivolous things, really, and yet he's still able to go into the layers that exist within this sort of almost palace of the unreal, but it becomes a meaningful space for him. And so I guess that's what really sort of struck me. And it struck me how we often, I guess in my own work then, if I started to think about it in relation to my own work, is that particularly, I guess, in Holocaust museums, the obsession with the real, right, is understandable. Like, it's very understandable, you know, with the phenomena of Holocaust denial, et cetera, et cetera. But it often, in some ways, works against what you're trying to do in that space, I think, which is to bring people into an emotional space as well. And not that the real can't do that, but there are other ways, I guess, of engaging with that. And I think that's what Anders shows as well, is that in his engagement with really the unreal, the fake, the frivolous, he finds this sort of reality. So I guess that, yeah, that's a quite a long-winded way of saying why it became intriguing to me.
I mean, not at all. You know, that's why we're here, to really dive in deep. You know, that's exactly the point. So we might just take it over to Alina there and say the same to you, Alina, like, and ask the same question of you, really. Why, like, why is this interesting? As Avril points out, you know, it's kind of absurd, but is that what interests you about it?
Well, similarly, I mean, I knew zero about this writer before, so it's always interesting to learn something new and so forth. I think, so the study of sort of the reception of antiquity, of Greco-Roman antiquity at least, is quite a big field. This will be kind of part of it. So this idea of how it's been reconstructed and reconstructed and reconstructed, because this is a world that's never really been forgotten. Right? So there are ancient worlds that were forgotten and kind of rediscovered. This one has had people responding to it since its existence, including within that world itself, with the Romans responding to the Greeks, or Romans responding to ancient Egypt, for example, and reconstructing it based on what they could find. And then, so yeah, reconstructing a version of the past themselves, and now we're receiving that later on, and reconstructing, you know, like there's layers and layers and layers, right? So that's what I thought that was really interesting. I mean, again, yeah, just the broader topic of how antiquity is found in Hollywood and how much it's played such a huge role in our imaginings of that ancient world. Hollywood didn't invent the concepts of things. Like I said, this world wasn't forgotten or anything like that. But it's interesting to see how, especially specifically in this context of a European who was exiled from Europe, is coming to a different context, which has been reconstructing this ancient world, not the same way that Europe had been reconstructing this ancient world. And his response to it. I also, because I worked in California before, in a museum that is also a reconstruction of the ancient world, which was at the Getty, which is a museum based on an ancient building. All these things kind of combined, right? All these things combined are the things that I'm interested in my own actual personal work experience and stuff like that. So it's a fascinating text and now audio play that you have created.
We might just quickly take it to Chris to add maybe also a bit more about, because Chris was the original translator of the diary from German into English. So maybe Chris can also say a bit more about the work itself and his take on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard when one translates texts. There is such a breadth of material one could translate. And especially with Anders, who wrote something like 30 books and hundreds of shorter pieces, it's always a challenge. What do I choose to translate and why should one translate certain texts? But this one was really a bit of a no-brainer for me because it's such a vivid reflection on history and on the philosophy of history. I think Anna Pollmann, one of our podcast guests, actually unpacked that context really in great detail in a book that in California especially and in German Jewish thought, there was these debates about history. What is history? Is history progressing? Can we still talk of historical progress in a world in which there's these catastrophic wars and events and persecution? What about all these lofty ideals that are handed down from antiquity, the Renaissance, and how they're being hollowed out, I guess, by the world that these ideals are helping to create? And so in that context, the diary for me has always been incredibly fascinating for the way it taps into a very deep intellectual conversation that is ongoing, but reframes it almost using the techniques it's critiquing. It wants to be kind of popular, accessible. It's kind of a soap opera or whatever you want to call it, a caricature maybe also of a university, because at the time it was published, Anders would have long since given up on an academic career, but I guess he was in a comparative situation to what today would be called an adjunct, so always teaching in kind of insecure roles. So there's the whole wider context of this diary that made it a very fascinating one.
And I think just to interrupt you quickly here, because I thought, isn't it almost to repeat what Everett has said, isn't it almost absurdly funny that we're now academics sitting here doing exactly that, talking about the academic who said isn't actually the right way of sharing our expertise, you know, getting the word out, connecting to the work, because what, you know, of what you were pointing out, working in the Holocaust Museum and Commemoration space, and what Alina points out, working in the space where history is literally always repeated, and she presents on how, you know, history was repeated by people in history. So again, how would you react to the way that the diary is actually kind of almost making fun of that, like making fun of us becoming these experts of how to frame the real in unreal / real terms? Like, isn't it, I don't know, I'm still trying also to make sense of it because I still think it's very confronting at times to think about it like that. But let me just get your reactions there.
I think what it makes me think about is how stuck on concepts of time we are. Do you know, like if we really think about it, we know that we've constructed the ideas of time, right, and measuring it and all of those kinds of things, yet we're sort of slaves to it. And I think that's a sort of theme for Anders, like, what are we slaves to? What do we not think about? You know, what do we just sort of accept? And how does that then change the way we look at things? And one of the passages, I'm not going to be able to quote it directly, but it's where he sort of almost, he talks about what if, you know, what if these things that we consider history, right, with a capital H, all of the kinds of things that Alida studies, the great monuments of Rome and, you know, the great places of Europe, what if they just were destroyed? And then we have to somehow, what we've done in terms of representing them, is that going to become history? Right? Is that then going to sort of take its place? And in some ways, I feel like that's what time does, right? But we don't recognize it, to place, right? That sort of relationship between time and place, where so it made me think about sort of monuments that have changed over time. Right, but not because they themselves have changed. And for me, the one that I find most fascinating is probably the Western or the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, right? Because it begins its life as a retainer wall for the Second Temple. Right? So it's not a very important wall, actually, within the context of that particular space. It was an outside wall. And you know, with temple architecture, the sort of, if you like, the importance, the sacredness of a space gets closer and closer to where the sort of what I guess scholars refer to as the Axis Mundi, the central space where supposedly the tablets of the covenant were stored, only the priests could go into, and it was seen as almost like the place where heaven and earth meet. And this was very far, right? Very far from that space. It was just an ordinary retainer wall. And then, of course, you have the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans, the great dispersal, and it becomes the Wailing Wall, right? It's the place where people go to wail and mourn the destruction of Jerusalem. But it's the same wall, right? It's the same wall. It's just that time and events and things are changing all the way around it. And so it becomes almost it becomes a symbol of diaspora, right? It's no longer a sovereign symbol. It's a symbol of diaspora. And then, of course, the next probably most famous photograph of the wall is the 67 war and the Israeli soldiers reaching the wall and the reclamation of the wall then as a symbol of state. Right, and a symbol of sovereignty, and all of then the sort of the glory and problematics of that moment, right, in time, and yet the wall is the same. And so I guess what Anders' writing really makes me think about is how space is contingent on time and events, and yet we like to think of space as so concrete, you know, literally concrete, like it doesn't change, but of course it does. You know, and I guess that's what his writing is constantly doing for me, to sort of shaking up those fundamental ideas that we have about things as constants, you know, and yet, of course, they're not, you know, they're not. So, again, I'm not sure that speaks exactly to what you're talking about, but it was definitely something that sort of sparked my imagination as I was reading his diaries.
Can I add on the point of spaces being constants and stuff? I mean, one of the most famous monuments of Greco-Roman antiquity, the Parthenon, I think is a really good example of that, because that's where basically culture was so desperate for it to be that the old version of it got essentially rebuilt, because it was an ancient temple to Athena. Then for a long time, it was a Christian space. It was a mosque. It was a Christian space again. It was all those things for a lot longer than it was a temple to Athena, right? Then all of that got completely removed, and the temple to Athena was kind of recreated in this broken state in the 19th century, because people really, when we sort of make spaces contain the memories of history, we choose which memories, right? So even though these are material things, they're still kind of constructed by the culture that's doing it. And then now it continues. And today, most people don't know that space has been so many different things because it's been deliberately made to represent its origins, which I think is interesting. So we'll see what happens in the next few thousand years.
Oh, it'd be super interesting. I mean, just coming in on that question of origins and the original, it's too tempting a kind of a segue to think about. I mean, there is a certain parody at work in that text that I'm still not able to unravel, even though I spent so much time with it, where I'm not quite sure to what extent Anders tries to mock the idea of the original itself and say, well, there never was one. Or he has this kind of like melancholy kind of realization that all these originals are kind of being lost and changed. So I thought it would just be interesting to return to that point, Avril, you were making about the Holocaust being, you know, the importance of having the real or the original or the kind of authoritative version commemorated in a space, in a museum space, perhaps, that can kind of confront people with the past in ways that perhaps other spaces can't. So I'd just be interested to hear a bit more about the way, I guess, Anders's thoughts shape your wider perspective on museum practice and museum studies in that space.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing that people, you know, they've done surveys about this. People have a huge amount of trust in museums and what they do and what they represent, and even more so than, I know we'll find this hard to believe, than universities. And, you know, and that's quite an sort of,
you know,
yeah, quite an incredible thing, really. But actually, you know, I think anyone who's ever thought seriously about museums and seriously about what they do know that really what they undertake all the time is a process of interpretation, right, and representation, and going back to their sources, their objects or their images or their, you know, the texts that they use, the documents, and reassessing them, right, in different ways and reinterpreting them. And I think that's part of what a really good curator is able to do, is to act as an interpreter of those objects, which is precisely what Anders does, by the way, with his objects. Like, he interprets them for us. He contemplates them. He sees them anew. He thinks of what stories they could tell. And so I think with Holocaust museums, it is a very sensitive space, obviously, for obvious reasons. But if you're not reinterpreting the material, you're probably not going to be able to make the kind of connection you want to make. And, you know, for one of my research projects, I looked a lot at the history of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which is a really sort of fascinating study. It was one of the sort of seminal museums, set new standards in certainly for Holocaust museums, but really for museums in general. And the first project director, Michael Berenbaum, was nice enough to give me an interview. And I remember he's trained both as a theologian and as a historian, and then ends up being project director of this, you know, very important museum at its inception. And I said to him, you know, how do you feel about critiques about the museum that talk about its Americanization, you know, that it's Americanized the Holocaust? Because really what I guess that critique is saying in essence is you've changed the story, you know, you've made it into something else. And in some ways that's true. Like if anyone's ever been to the museum, they still use the basis of their original display because it was so successful, even though it opened in 93, they're still using the main segments of it. You go up to the top of the exhibition in an elevator or a lift, right, where you hear the voices of American liberators, and you come out into a space where you sort of then begin your journey through through what the Holocaust was. So you begin at the end, so to speak. And of course, the end is characterized as a story of America being the liberators. Now, we know in a sense that that's true and it's not true, right? The Americans do liberate some of the camps, but they do it to end the war. They don't do it to save the concentration camp victims, right? That's an explicit policy of the Allies, is that we will win the war, and in winning the war, we will liberate these people, not the other way round, right? So as we were discussing this, he said to me, well, you know, when I think about what people are saying, they're probably right, he said, but I also think about it as a theologian. And as a theologian, I think about the texts of our tradition and what they tell us about what it means to communicate something. And he quoted the very famous psalm, you know, by the rivers of Babylon, which is a psalm about the first exile into Babylon. And in that psalm, right, there's a sort of declarative point where the psalmist says, how will we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, right? And really, you know, we see it as this sort of beautiful declarative statement, which it is, but it's also a very practical question, right? Up until this point, it was a sovereign religion that was undertaken in a sovereign space. And what the exiles are saying is this actually possible? Like, can we do it? And Michael Berenbaum's answer was, well, they did it by speaking those you know, those truths, so to speak, or their faith from where they stood, right? And it's true, they changed. The Babylonian exile was the beginnings of diasporic Judaism, right? But if they had not been able to do that, they would not have saved anything, right? So I guess that in a sense is his point, right, is that actually the process of interpretation is a process of salvaging something, right, and making it real again. And I think that's the thing we sometimes forget, right? And that's what's so fascinating to me about Alina's work, right, is that she gets to trace that process of, like, you know, reinterpret, and making these things really literally sort of speak again, which I see as a sort of quite a profound project. I don't see it as somehow a lie or a fake or, you know, all those pejorative terms that we like to use.
And maybe, Alina, if you could maybe talk a bit about that, because one of the lines you said before, like, fortunately we haven't captured it on audio, but you were saying something also, you know, consensus is established, or reality is established by consensus. So the more the people engage with something, the really it becomes. So, and as Everett was pointing out, the point of view and interpretation is also aiding in that. Could you maybe talk a bit more about that and how you see that at work in your professional practice and at museums at large?
I think that actually was about, I was talking about forgeries, right? So yeah, in a previous thing, we were talking about real and fake and so forth, and what is the place of forgery? And I said, well, reality is determined by consensus, because sometimes when you try and decide if an ancient object is real or not, it's really just how many experts will agree that it is. And then in the 19th century, they might agree that it is, and in the 20th century, they might agree that it's not. And it's not like what a lot of people think. Science doesn't always sort of answer these questions, because when you see they do sort of scientific testing on objects and stuff, and it just creates more confusions and more problems about consensus. So that's sort of another layer. So there's the sort of construction of pasts and presents and so forth. And then there's also the deliberate creation of things that are pretending to be old, right? But on the point that Avril was talking about with how museums sort of reinterpret things over and over and over, it is actually, yeah, really fascinating to study. And I wish it was sort of documented better, because, so for example, I like to, yeah, like, you know, you can go to an exhibition now and see how objects have been interpreted. But I'd love to be able to walk through that space 20 years ago, or that walk through that space 50 years ago, you know, because those same objects were made to tell a different message or in a slightly different way. And sometimes, and because of the genre of exhibitions where you have so few words to play with, because just the labels are so short, sometimes these reinterpretations are so subtle. And unfortunately, because of the fact that, I mean, there are online exhibitions now, so I guess you could in future look at older versions of those. But the ones that actually have that space that you walk through in the gallery space, like you can't just keep, you know, those galleries stuck forever and build a whole new gallery to reinterpret, right? It has to, like, that materiality and relationships in space is lost unless you document it. And even when you document it, it's still not the same as being there and seeing the relationships in space and sight lines and so forth. So it's quite an interesting thing where we're recreating the past over and over and over, and then actively every time we interpret, we do sort of remove everything that we've done and sort of remove the possibility of re-experiencing our past interpretation.
I mean, what both of you are saying really resonates with the work of translation, I guess, from where this project in a sense emerges. And Anders's, I think, second cousin, Walter Benjamin, wrote a very famous piece on translating in which he says that the act of translation inflicts a kind of death on the original because it has to transpose it into a new kind of context. But he uses this really enigmatic line where he says, at the same time, it is also the life of the original, because if it wasn't translated, it would be lost, forgotten. There couldn't be an experience of it. It couldn't travel across into that new context. I mean, for me, that's emerging more and more as one of the central questions. You know, how do we find this language? How do we find ways to make engagements with the past and the really profoundly difficult questions that come up in that context, ones where people can feel included, feel a stake, feel activated and spoken to. And obviously Hollywood does this tremendously well in a commercial sense that it screens for us this. So there's not really a question I have here, but I'm interested maybe more about some of the ethics that for you come up in these kind of spaces when you're working with the past and when you're trying to curate the past. What are some of the factors that, you know, shape your processes?
I think the most difficult thing for Holocaust museums is the graphic nature of the materials, and that comes up again and again. And one scholar who's written very sort of movingly on it is James Young, who's written a lot about Holocaust memorials and museums, and he makes the point that when you see the hair at Auschwitz or the suitcases or the shoes, you know, are you actually remembering the victims, or are you remembering them the way that the Nazis would have us remember them, basically? And I think it's a point that I come back to again and again and again, because it brings up this sort of really profound, I think, ethical problem of who are you representing? You know, these people were not who they were when they were brought, you know, on a 3 or a 6 day journey to Auschwitz in a cattle train and taken off and dehumanized and ultimately murdered. They had lives, they had families, they had careers, they had cultures, they had language, you know, and in sort of putting the emphasis, I guess, on their end, you know, their murder, you do, I think, inherently do some damage. And it's a really tricky dilemma. And we had a very sort of, I still don't think we actually resolved it very well, but we had a very difficult issue come up at the museum when we were redoing the Holocaust exhibit, which was about sort of 4 or 5 years ago now, where we have a lot of volunteers at the museum. Some are survivors, some are not survivors. And we were rethinking how to do the medical experimentation part of the display, which has some of the most sort of shocking and confronting images probably in the entire corpus. And we got a letter from one of the volunteers who said, "I've always been, you know, deeply disturbed by this section, and I feel that these people were humiliated and tortured once, and every time you put their pictures up on display, you humiliate and torture them again." You know, and it really hit us hard as a curatorial team. We really sort of sat with it. We didn't know what to do. And we thought, well, that person's actually made a fair enough point. So we then thought, well, we need to discuss this with other people. And we talked to some survivors about it. And what was quite interesting was that most of them had the opposite reaction. They said, no, you have to show it how it was, you know, and that's your job, right? So they instinctively went for, I guess, what we're talking about, the sort of the real. I want them to see the real. But for us, we could really see the ethical point that was being made. And in the end, we made a sort of compromise, which, as I say, I'm still not really happy with, but we basically created a space where these kinds of images were sort of tucked away and you had to, like, consciously go and find them, pull the drawer out, look at them. So they weren't, you know, in your face kind of images. I don't think that actually solves the problem, you know, like it doesn't really solve the problem. It solved a sort of practical problem, I guess, for us. But the ethical problem, I think, remains. And to be honest, I don't really know what you do about it, but I do know, in a way, and this is from, you know, I guess, experiencing other forms of curation, that there might be more powerful ways of dealing with these things. And I guess the example that I'd give is, there's a wonderful curator, Felicitas Jelinek in Austria. She works as a consultant for various museums, and she was asked a few years ago to do an exhibition, a special exhibition for the anniversary of Kristallnacht. And at first she thought, you know, I don't want to do this Kristallnacht. It's been, you know, it's been done so many times, and how do you do it differently? And then she thought about it and she thought, well, actually maybe there's a sort of opportunity here. And so she started looking at the material. And the way she decided to start the exhibition, which is usually started, of course, with the call from Goebbels to begin the pogrom, and, you know, in reaction to the shooting, et cetera, et cetera. And instead she trawled through newspaper after newspaper, and she found the first report of someone who'd taken their own life as a result of hearing the events of Kristallnacht and what had happened. And that's how she started the exhibition. And I thought, like, that's a really powerful way of thinking differently about history, what history means, what that particular historical event meant, you know, and puts the whole thing in a different perspective. So I think it's, you know, if I had my time again, I'd try and have more of those moments with regard to developing a Holocaust display, because I think there are ways of sort of tapping into something that's more powerful than just a really atrocious image that, you know, kind of sickens your stomach. And is that what you really want anyway?
If I may just tag on a quick question there for maybe Avril and both Avril and Alina, if that's okay, because Avril, as you pointed out, so there's this dilemma of the curator and the ethics around it. So maybe if Alina could also comment on that, just, you know, talk on that if you'd like. But because Hollywood has become this massive, you know, curatorial hall of things, you know, and they're presenting to us the Holocaust, they're giving to us the Shoah, you know, these massive Hollywood productions. So in a way, you're competing with that. Both, like Aline is competing with that, you know, in the way that ancient history is being put on stage and is being, you know, Hollywoodized. And they have so much money and they have all these, you know, experts. They have thousands of people trying to feed into the, in making it glitzier, shinier, better, nicer, you know, so much more alluring than maybe a tiny museum in the middle of nowhere could, you know. Just, so do you feel there's a pressure of competing with that huge curatorial, you know, reality industry of Hollywood? Because when you read all, you know, the people giving testimony, like The Last Survivors, Avril and I had talked a bit about that, it's saying, you know, you can't have the Holocaust without the Holocaust. But Hollywood is doing exactly that, and yet still people know Schindler's List, you know, there's these films that are implementing themselves so much into the reproduction of that history. So where do you think, you know, you as, or, you know, curators, museums, how do they compete? I don't know if that's the real word or the, you know, the best word for that. Is it a competition? Should it be something else? I'd be just really interested in from a pop culture angle, because the same questions about ethics really are missing in the pop culture industry, because it's got billions of dollars, you know, euros or whatnot, but there's just no sense of ethics with it, because it kind of escapes through the door of entertainment. So just as, you know, the museum has a responsibility. We have tickets to sell, you know, bums in the seats, Netflix audiences to make happy. So, yeah, if you could just, I'd be really happy if you could maybe talk a bit about that, because I'm very interested in how to solve that dilemma also.
Well, I can say that, yeah, with the Greco-Roman world, definitely, you know, if a movie comes out and it's popular, and this was, I think, more so a bigger deal in the 2000s than lately. I think people are a bit more tired of these movies than they were. But when there was Troy and all that, it was always like, how can we tap into the sudden interest in Gladiator, right? Let's do all these exhibitions on Rome, all this sort of stuff. Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, I don't know if this is, I think I read somewhere that Russell Crowe at some point said that, Rome, the city I made famous, or something like that. I don't know if that's true. I hope it's true because it's amazing. But that could be one of those factoids off the internet. I don't know. But there's a definite sort of, you know, you have to have the word treasure in your exhibition title. You have to have the word civilization in your exhibition title, which I think in this sort of mentality, I think is definitely spurred on by movies that are so bombastic about a lot of things, which are, you know, if it was up to me and a lot of other curators using the words treasure and civilization, like, no way, right? Because they're more problematic than they're worth, I think. But unfortunately, that's how, yeah, like, that's at least it's seen as very marketable that way. I think that sometimes there are, because obviously the context that we're talking about are very, very different. The people that I'm talking about are, you know, thousands of years ago. So sometimes we're stuck with at least the ancient material where it actually talks about some really confronting stuff, but because it's from so long ago, it kind of gets dehumanized. And it also doesn't help that a lot of the way that they presented it, it's kind of in the realm of beauty sometimes. So like there's, you know, ancient sculpture where it's literally like, if you didn't know anything about its context, it's about to be violence against women, right? Like it's about to be quite graphic and terrible, but it's this beauty, it was sculpted as a beautiful sculpture, and then we put it on display, and what label do we put on it, right? So it would often in the past be something like satyr playing with a nymph or something like that. But then can we use words like rape? Can we, you know, like this is what I mean by it. The genre of museum labels is so small. You have so few words. You have to choose them very carefully. And there's definitely a rethinking a lot of the time about how these things have been labeled, how before everything was so, like, a lot of the time things were sanitized, but also how far are we allowed to go, right, without being too confronting to a modern audience? Or should we be confronting to a modern, really confronting to a modern audience? But then, you know, the modern visitors are all different, so it's going to affect some more than others, and is that fair, and so forth.
Particularly here, I think, when I walked in, Chris also was there with me, we walked into MoMA, Museum in Hobart, and there's this scene of beautiful swan, you know, seducing woman, and a friend of mine, she had a very visceral reaction to that. No, this is a rape. But how can, you know, and I think, yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's a really good point.
Definitely, you know, so for example, if you study, you know, ancient Greek and Roman texts and this sculpture and stuff at university, for example, they absolutely talk about it, you know, and, you know, with warnings and so forth. But in a museum, you have a lot less space. Like, you don't have your 2-hour lecture to explain and discuss and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it's quite difficult. Like, I mean, I've seen it before in an exhibition I helped with where we had a particular sculpture. I mean, there's also the line between myth and human. So sometimes it's mythological creatures that they're not even humanoid. And where does that stand, right, with that sort of stuff? And so we had this particular object that kind of got put into a little corridor, just so that, you know, you didn't, and there was a warning before, and, you know, you didn't have to go in there, and that way, you know, school groups could avoid it if they wanted to, and that, and so forth. In the Archaeological Museum of Naples, actually, all the sort of explicitly sexual material is kept in this room that's known as the secret cabinet, which today is just another room, but before you had to get permission from the king to enter that space, because it was considered, you know, too much for the public and so forth. Sorry, I'm getting further away from. I was going to say, well, Hollywood, though I think that because also the world, so this world is very long ago, sometimes they are very, very like dramatic about how they show violence and so forth, more so than our texts or objects do. And then so they can claim a reality that we can't, because. Yeah, like there are some, for example, the lives of enslaved people in the ancient world and the way that they've been portrayed in some TV shows, some would argue are very sort of accurate is hard to say because we know so little, right? But that they're more realistic because our text, apart from barely ever mentioning these people, if they do, it doesn't really, you know, probably show the full reality of things. So sometimes Hollywood has this sort of freedom to potentially show a more realistic perspective.
Yeah, I mean, the role of Hollywood really in driving, I guess, awareness of the Holocaust is huge. I mean, when you think about films like Schindler's List or The Pianist, or, you know, we could go on and on. So on the one hand, it's been a very important sort of, I guess, tool in terms of getting a sort of a history out there that may not have gotten the kind of currency that it has, except for through this medium. But then, of course, there are hugely problematic aspects to it, in that Hollywood loves a good redemptive tale. And the Holocaust is not a redemptive tale, right? It's just not. So what do you do with that? And then, you know, you have films like Karl Landsman's Shoah, which is a 9-hour documentary that is basically all interviews with, you know, survivors, perpetrators, bystanders, etc. And not a lot of people are going to watch 9 hours. But even the, I think what's kind of brilliant about what Landsman does, I mean, there's a lot of things about his work that are just so intriguing, but he it's always referred to as a documentary, but he refers to it as a work of art, right? And so what I guess is always at play in his work is the constructedness of the interview, and yet at the same time, the appearance of the authenticity of the interview, right? To come back to an Anders kind of point, right? You've got that sort of thing happening all the time, right? You believe you are looking at sort of unmediated interview footage, which in a sense you are, but it's been carefully structured and carefully thought through. And the, you know, the scene that is probably most talked about in that way is the scene with the survivor, Abraham Bomba, who was a barber before the war and was was forced to work as a barber in Treblinka, where he cut victims' hair. And then Lansman talks to him about, like, arranges this with him, interviews him as he's cutting people's hair. He's getting, you know, and being filmed, he's asking him to retell his story. And so, you know, and there's all sorts of, like, sort of interesting filmic techniques that are used, the use of mirrors, you see him from various angles. It's incredibly sort of emotive the way that Lansman sets it up. And you know that this has been a constructed interview, but at the same time, he, in that construction, Lansman brings Bomba to a point that most, you know, sort of testimonial interviews cannot do, because he brings him to the point of this sort of unspeakable moment where he can't talk anymore. He recounts a moment where he sees his friend, who's also working as a barber, sees his wife and his sister come into the gas chambers, and then he can't speak anymore. And you know, you feel something in that that you don't feel from a simple, in a sense, a recounting kind of interview. So I guess it's a sort of incredible moment where you sort of, Anders' point becomes real, right? Becomes sort of something that really touches you, which is that something has been constructed, and yet out of it comes this incredible truth, right? This moment of truth and emotional power. And how does that work? You know, I've taught that scene so many times, I've watched it so many times, I've thought about it, and I still can't quite explain the power of that, because it is manipulative as well. You know, there's been a lot of discussion around whether Lansman should have done it. Is there was it ethical to do to Bomba what he did? Even if Bomba agreed to it, was that an ethical thing to do? But we wouldn't have that moment if he didn't do it, you know. So it's incredibly difficult, I think, working with that kind of material. So this is a very long-winded way of saying that that the power of film is undeniable. You know, the power of those productions is really extraordinary. But I think, you know, and I think museums, by the way, are susceptible to it, right? When I see the trend in Holocaust museums and other museums for, you know, anything to do with filming and footage and, you know, and it's true, there is something very powerful about that. But I think we have to be careful about it as well, because there's also something very powerful about a very simple object if it's curated properly, if you are able to bring something out about it. So, you know, for instance, one of my really, you know, favorite is probably the wrong word, but really all-time sort of, you know, most powerful objects is at the museum we have a headscarf that was basically half a piece of cloth. And what this cloth was it was used as a headscarf by a female prisoner in Auschwitz. And when she gave it to the museum, she explained that she felt so dehumanized by losing her hair and by what happened to her in the intake in Auschwitz that she traded a day's rations to get that half a piece of cloth to cover her head. And a day's rations in Auschwitz was the difference between life and death a lot of the time. You know, and so the power of that object is extraordinary, you know, to see that. And to think about what that meant to her in that, you know, in that moment, and that she kept it. I mean, that's the other thing that amazes me about a lot of objects, is that people keep them, you know, and then they also develop meaning over time. So while it's not, you know, it's not a competition in a sense, but I guess the two genres, to me, they do different things in some ways, and I think we've got to acknowledge that and work with that. But I do find some Hollywood productions very problematic. I guess I'll end there with that, yeah.
The object and the object focus of museums and what you're foregrounding, perhaps, to me, when I was working or am working with Anders, I realized that a lot of his texts work precisely because they have this uncanny ability to dramatize for us an object and to kind of place it in front of us to kind of make something very abstract, very hard to access, very concrete. It's running, you know, when he talks about television and the way it changes the work, the world. He talks about how people rearrange their living room, you know, as a kind of around the TV. And it's not metaphorical. It's completely accessible, completely concrete. And I often think that when I listen to people talking about museums and curation and all these questions, that there is something fairly unique that objects can do when we engage with them from, I guess, all sorts of different perspectives and disciplines. So maybe this is a bit of a very open, broad question, but connects to what Ben was saying right in the beginning, when I think we were talking with you, Alina, about the reality of objects and how it makes, does it even make sense to use terms such as fake, real, and so forth when we're dealing with material culture? Or are they kind of dead ends or questions that kind of maybe set up false problems? So just basically a very open question about objects themselves and what they allow us to do or stage in ways that maybe our kind of more wordy modes of address fail to do.
I think that, I mean, there's this definite sort of thought that objects provide a tangible link to the past, right? This is terminology that is used all the time. I'm pretty sure I've seen it on a UNESCO website before and so forth, which is true. But I think we need to complicate what that means, because it's almost like, at least in my world, it's kind of, they're often like put in opposition to texts. So, but texts are, you know, their opinions, so they're so biased, right? Well, objects, well, it's the thing, right? So it creates this tangible link. So it's not, it doesn't have those problems, but in reality, it does. There's still, you know, the bias of survival. Like, why has this thing survived? Why has it, and something else hasn't? And what gaps do we have in the past? Because some things were made of materials that haven't survived. Like, why are some materials have been more valued, so they've been actively collected, while others have been thrown out? And then, I mean, some things are still thrown out by archaeologists even today, right? So there's still a lot of parameters. And also, some objects were used to represent the past in the past. So when we get them, they're already sort of the remainders of an act of reception, right? So they're complicated, basically. Even though they're material, they're in front of us, but they're very, very complicated. And the question of, does it matter if you say something's fake or is it real? I mean, it depends on what your parameters are, right? So I mean, if it's an object, it's presumably, yeah, in front of you. Or it could be a digital object, but I guess that's still in front of you. So it's not an imagined thing. But what do you mean when you say real? Do you mean it was... like, yeah, was it because it was made by an ancient hand versus something that was made today but looks exactly the same? Does it, yeah, what was the intention of the maker? So that's the question of forgeries, for example. Is something more real because it wasn't made with the intention to lie to you? So, yeah, your parameters of authenticity depend on how you want to describe something. So.
Just to chime in there, because I think that's what I've really so beautifully teased out. So, you know, what, like, the question is, what was this object meant to do? Like, what do you know, what is the showing, like, what is that production meant to do? And when, you know, Aline is asking, what is it meant to do, this object? Like, when you have to decipher, decode, because it's not just a neutral object, like, as Anders points out, you know, these, like, when he has this section about the Nazi boots, you know, and they are meant to evoke that reaction by having these blood speckled, you know, stains on them. So, there's a purpose behind the object, and it's not neutral. It's heavily coded by Hollywood, and it's being put in that montage of things, of feelings, and of, you know, impressions. So and this is something I was just wondering, Alina, if you could maybe also quickly add to that, if you'd like. So does it then matter? So because these objects are so powerful, there's a hidden technology that's resting in those objects of these powers, as Avril points out, this half headscarf that's there. So as a curator, or as, you know, somebody working in Holocaust museums, how did you come to be able to do that work? Like, you know, that expertise and that work around these objects. Can you maybe just talk a bit about that process? Because as Anders is pointing out, you know, there's people trained in faking that, and you're trained in, you know, making it, I don't even know the word, authoritative, like real. So how would you differentiate between yourselves and these people working in the cost? I know, but this might be completely offensive. But so how do we do that? Like, how do we think of ourselves as these, or how do you think of yourselves as in that kind of work you're in?
Do you want to answer that?
I can make a start. It's a very interesting question. I mean, you know, for me personally, I kind of fell into curatorial work because I've always done more education work, you know, sort of in my time before becoming an academic and obviously since becoming an academic. So I actually started at the Museum in Education, but because I had expertise in Jewish history and Holocaust history, when it came time to think rethinking major displays, it was that expertise was kind of needed. So for me, working with objects was and still is an ongoing process of learning. And I really appreciate what Alina was saying, because they don't just sort of offer themselves up. Like, there's a lot of work involved in understanding what you're looking at, you know, and sometimes it takes a lot of people to figure it out, to be totally honest. Like, when we were looking at things that have provenance that, you know, goes well beyond, say, my expertise or the expertise of Conrad Creed, who's the resident historian at the museum, we really, you know, you realize that actually figuring out what am I looking at is quite a difficult thing. But also then I think you know, I always feel that in some ways you are similar to Anders or to someone who's working in Hollywood, because you then do create something with that thing, right? It's not just a process of breaking down what you're looking at. You then want to in some way employ that object, you know, and get it to speak in a different way and get it to be part of a narrative or part of a, I don't know, an experience, you know. And so you are involved in a creative act. And I feel that it's, you know, it's probably good to be, you know, I guess, well, conscious of that, I guess, conscious of that as a curator and in what you're doing, rather than sort of this sense of like, oh, well, of course this should go here because it's sort of blah, 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 it has this kind of authority and this kind of provenance, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I guess that to me is sort of the interesting part of the work. It's the creative part of the work. But I guess, you know, it's funny because we keep circling back to the same issues, but there is I guess the thing that you struggle with as well, or at least that I struggle with in terms of these objects, is what visitors want out of them. And they often do want the real, right? I'm sure this happens more to a leader, in fact, than to me, because people love the idea of connecting with something real in the ancient world, you know. So I think dealing with that expectation is also quite difficult, you know. And they're often really kind of upset if you don't give them that, if you don't give them their vision of what the real is, you know. And in a history museum, that can become quite contentious. And, you know, I've been doing some work studying the history of the National Museum of Australia down in Canberra recently because of the Holocaust architecture that's in the Gallery of the First Australians, which is a reference to the Liebeskind Museum in Berlin. And Dawn Casey, who was the inaugural director and an Indigenous woman, she managed like a storm of controversy about this museum. And she said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but at one point she gave an interview and she said, you know, most people like what we've done. In other words, we've sort of shaken up their vision of Australian history. But those who don't like it really don't like it, right? because they, what we've done is we've taken their vision of the real and we've destroyed it. You know, we've destroyed it. We've actually given them a vision of Australian history that makes them think and is problematic and is disturbing and is, you know, all of those things, as well as celebratory narrative in parts as well. And I think, you know, it's true, people in some ways want to come to museums to have their values confirmed, right? And they get upset when they come and they're disturbed, you know. But most curators want the latter, right? They want people to go out thinking, whoa, wow, okay, I've changed the way I've thought about that.
And that, you know, and that is the tradition of expectations of reality. Like when Chris and I were doing the script and, you know, we had this same discussion. I hope it's okay just to mention that a bit, because we were talking a lot about, you know, Chris also, because Chris has also, there's a sense of responsibility, you know. So do people expect something out of a specific translation? So again, do you have, you know, do you come to this with a set of expectations? Is it real enough? Do you save the essence of the, you know, what happened? What's the consequence of not honoring that kind of spoke, you know, implicit contract between you and the audience? You know, it's a big part of that. And how do you deal with that? But Alina, if you'd like to answer that, be quite fascinating.
Well, I mean, definitely. I mean, like I said before, because the Greco-Roman world has never been forgotten, people definitely have a lot of ideas about it, which is compounded by and created by a lot of Hollywood. And then it can, yes, sometimes there can be a disconnect between what people want to see or expect to see and then what people might actually put on display or how they might present it. One example of this is, the role of women, because, you know, there's this constant idea that we can't know anything about women in the ancient world, you know, like they weren't the writers. They didn't, like, all they did was make babies, whatever else, right? It's not true. There's plenty of evidence, right? There's plenty of stories we can tell. But as soon as you try and question the idea that every object must have been made by a man, right, then you get all the Facebook comments of like, oh, but as if, right? Like, there's no evidence for this. Well, there's actually no evidence that everything was made by a man either. That's just the assumption that people have. That's the assumption they come with. So when you try and question it and say, maybe it could not be, then suddenly it's, you know, you're rewriting history from your modern perspective and you're not, you know, telling the truth and it's not real anymore and so forth. And there's kind of sort of different interests to balance here, between sort of trying to tell a very specific complex story and also things like marketing and so forth. So there's, you know, there's a lot of people beyond the curator within a museum. I'm not saying that they have sort of nefarious wants and needs or anything like that, but there still is a lot of sort of things to balance when you make an exhibition. And some museums have more freedoms than others. But in terms of sort of comparing us to Hollywood, that's a good question. I think that, are we different to Hollywood, to filmmakers and so forth? I think some of the idea of constructing a version of the past, I mean, you can say that that's what we do. We're constantly interrogating how we're doing that, probably with a different way to how I'm sure that people who make movies do as well. But I think the sort of priorities and the direction that question will go will be different, I assume. But I've never made a movie, so.
It really ties in. I mean, both these angles tie in with what Anders calls the newest past, you know, the past our parents didn't know, this constant reframing of the past that, you know, paradoxically, we always need the new angle onto the supposedly long forgotten and long past item to keep our interest. And maybe with that in mind, the diary itself ends in this really quite abrupt and I guess quite powerful manner when Anders relates a conversation where he's kind of moaning about his experience at the palace and about how everything, you know, is so difficult for him to deal with because he's in this hypocritical space where there's all these kind of fake objects. And the conversation ends with kind of pointing out that, well, you know, this is kind of a luxury problem to have. This is not really something that a concern that might be shared by like, I think he's pointing to road workers or something like that, who are kind of struggling to survive. So it kind of brings it back into kind of present hardship. I guess that's where I'm trying to go. And this kind of confrontation with the present itself. And now I know that it's a very wide arc, but how does the present as a kind of a temporal space and the kind of concerns that we are navigating in our day-to-day life tie in with your wider kind of fields of practice, I guess? Is there a way in which you feel the past needs to be in a very open dialogue, or is it best kept discreet, separate? Like, how do you deal with those kind of temporal compromises? It's something we as translators always have to do, because a very pragmatic example would be, you know, when a text is, say, very chauvinistic or patriarchal, what do you do? Do you save that at the risk that everyone will only see that and no longer see the rest of the text? Or do you kind of erase it? Or how do you cater to these concerns of the present, which may or may not be concerns of the past?
Well, I mean, I think the debate that's been going on for the last few years around monuments is a really interesting example of what you're talking about. You know, like a monument of Captain Cook in Hyde Park is a very different monument to an Indigenous person walking past than it is, say, to someone who came, who has British ancestry or even no connection to Britain or non-Indigenous. You know, so how do we think about those monuments? What do we do with them? They are part, as you said, they're part of our past, but they mean something very different as we, you know, hopefully become more aware as a society of the fullness of Australian history and the difficult parts of Australian history. I think you can reinterpret. I think that is possible, you know. That certainly happens with other kinds of monuments around the world where you the monument itself, in a sense, is contextualized and explained and other monuments are put up alongside of it. That's one option. We know in some countries the monument gets toppled, you know, and in that way it's a statement in and of itself of what that monument means in the present. So I guess it is, yeah, it is an interesting dilemma for us as to how we can relate to difficult aspects of our past in the present. And I think it is definitely an ongoing part of certainly the work I do and I'm sure for Alina as well. And it also, I think, as Alina was saying, like it's maintaining a sort of interrogative, for want of a better, an interrogative posture with regard to the past. And I think that does make a substantial difference to the work that you do, never sort of giving up on that process of questioning and thinking about it and reinterpreting it, and you know, all of those are really important positions, I think, to take when undertaking this kind of professional work and educative work. It is, I think, it's really challenging. And also, I think, I guess, you know, the other thing that Anders made me think about, I can't remember exactly which part of the text it was, but the fact that we also have a particular kind of obsession with the past as quote unquote moderns, because we see the past as something we can't, that's very hard to access, right? I often think about that with objects, is that maybe that's why people love them so much, because they feel like somehow I'm going to access the past through this monument and reclaim that time. You know, it's a very sort of human desire, right? Whereas that's not necessarily the case if you look at, you know, a variety of cultures over time. There are cultures that bring the past into the present all the time through liturgy, through ritual, through connection to ancestors, right? Like, but we've become kind of disembodied. And so it's our one opportunity in some ways, right? It's one of our few opportunities is I'm going to grab hold of this, you know, through this object, through this monument. So I wonder if in some ways it's also about thinking about our own position with regard to what we think the past is, you know, and whether it is sort of, you know, we can't in a sense access it. It's done, right? I mean, that is the promise of modern historiography, right, is that if you work hard enough as a historian, you can recreate something that will never happen again, right? But that's just not the way that a lot of cultures think about their past, right? They actually want it to happen again. They want to bring it into the present, right, through these various techniques. So I guess it, you know, it also opens up all of that, like why do we think about the past in the way that we do?
It's the non-fungible token. You know, the past has become, it's like currency, that because it can't be repeated, it's so unique and valuable. So we have elevated it to a place of unique, you know, currency. So I thought, you know, as you ever points out, that's quite nice. Alina, would you have a take on that?
I think in relation to what Avril was saying, like with the connection to the past you get through things like monuments and so forth, some of it, sort of, it's almost like reenactment that we're looking for. We want to see the thing that was seen before, you know, we're seeing the actual object that was seen, or like, you know, museums where people handle stuff. They're like, it's like, oh, I'm holding the thing like an ancient person once held it, I can tell you we have some, for example, ancient ceramics that have fingerprints in them. And people like to sort of stick their own, you know, finger on the fingerprint. So sort of like it's the reenactment of that bodily posture with the object, right, that people are doing. And they think that creates a connection, even though your body is completely different. The way you're thinking about the object is completely different. But still, it's some kind of reenactment. In terms of your earlier point, the question about like, should we sort of be recreating it over and over and over and so forth? I think it's a responsibility to some extent. Because I think there was, especially with like the ancient Greco-Roman past has been used and reused sometimes for very terrible means. And there's a point where sometimes sort of it's presented as if at some point we got really objective about it. And so this version is the proper objective neutral version. And we need to really, like, if you create a new version, then that kind of rails against the idea that that previous version was so objective. So this is what I mean before by talking about like who made an object or so forth, where like the assumption is like, well, most logically, men were making these things. That's the most sort of objective, logical assumption, right? So that's the neutral assumption. But actually, that's a political assumption. So if you create a new version of the past using the same sources, your version of the past might be a response to your own context. But what you're also bringing to attention is the fact that the previous so-called neutral past that's existed for the last few hundred years was also a creation of its own context, also a response to those contemporary concerns of the 19th century historians or so forth. And I think that's really important. So it's kind of a, you know, thinking about your own field and sort of showing the subjectivity of the whole concept of the field of studying the past and so forth.
For me, like, there's so many things going off like a firework, as Alina points out. Like, we are, you know, drawn to this idea of past as mint, like this mint condition kind of product past, which I find so funny. You know, like a couple of these things. But what's a question we should have asked you now? We did in the past 60 minutes.
Gee, Alina, you're an ancient historian. Are there ancient precedents for the things that Gunter Anders says? Because yes, there are. and we've talked about this before, you know, before this event, but basically, yeah, that a lot of these conversations have happened, you know, for thousands of years, which I think is great. That, yeah, there's always an ancient version of, and I'm only speak for the Greco-Roman world, I'm sure all sorts of cultures were considering what does fake and authentic mean and so forth. There's lots of stories from ancient texts and stuff about them wondering like, oh, do I make this look old or not? Or we have objects that clearly people were making look old. Right, and then now we've dug them up. So you know, it's a conversation you can actually also have across time, which I think is really great.
Yeah, no, I agree. And a lot of I don't want to sort of, you know, take us too far off the path, you know, when we're so close to it. But a lot of what we've talked about, yeah, it did make me think about the fact that in more, I guess, I don't know what to call them, traditional cultures, but if I think about, you know, sort of traditional Judaism or the way traditional texts work in Judaism, there's really, it's quite interesting. There's not an emphasis on whether something is real, but whether it points to a greater truth. You know, I think that's in a way when I talk about like a different posture, you know, and I think that's what Anders does. Do you know, like he sort of engages the fake to make us think about these, I know truth itself is a contested term, but, you know, something deeper, you know, something that sits beyond the reality that we look at. And I guess that's what's kind of, I find really fascinating and perhaps limiting about our sort of dominant, you know, for want of a better term, Western culture, is that we somehow, we're sort of slaves to the idea of essence, you know, that we're going to find the one essence, we're going to find the truth, the origin, the key, the, you know, right, like the holy grail, so to speak. And I don't think, from my knowledge of other cultures, that's not necessarily the case. There are many, you know, there are many paths. What is that saying? There are many paths to truth, right? And And I
think, and to Rome. And, yeah, to Rome.
And to Rome, exactly.
As Alina would know.
Just, you know, just ask, what's his name? He's gone out of my head, the one that made it famous. Russell Crowe. Just ask Russell Crowe. There's many parts. But yeah, and I think that's what I really appreciated about Anders, is that he sort of made me think anew about that, you know, about, and sort of almost like an opening up of something again. And I found that valuable. So, yeah, thanks.
I think that distinction between real and greater truth is so well put. It's amazing, because I think just as Anders' context, he developed this method of writing that he called philosophical exaggeration, and he would make fun of people who insisted, but that's not how we can see it, that's not what really happened. And he says, no, well, you have to exaggerate it, otherwise you can't see it, otherwise the truth doesn't become visible. And he has this beautiful parable where he kind of makes fun of a virologist who would say, well, I'm not going to amplify anything, I'm just going to use my senses. And he's saying, well, when he creates like this big images of viruses, is he also exaggerating the danger, or is he making it visible? And he's kind of saying constantly, we need these kind of techniques to make things visible, to connect emotionally, intellectually, conceptually with these things that we just want to live past or suppress or ignore or look away from. So it's a really, really elegant way of putting it, real and greater truth. I took a note, I hope you don't mind. I think it's wonderfully put.
Yeah, but well, now you just have to wait for Hollywood to make a film about it, you know.
But I think that's what he was maybe trying to do, you know. Maybe this is the attempt of trying to make the film. But I have one question. I wrote down something, Alina. I don't know if it's completely inappropriate to ask. But I think you said you had this amazing anecdote.
Yeah, we were teased with, right. We were promised an amazing anecdote that would break the internet.
I haven't brought it up because it hasn't been directly relevant, okay? But I've been telling these guys, I have the story from the ancient world about puppies, which I think is really cool, right? So check this out. In terms of just sort of thinking about how authenticity is made, and could we do this in the contemporary world? So there's this story from an ancient Roman text about an older Rome than the text was from, about how a shield fell from the sky. Right? They were like, oh, well, it's obviously sacred. It must have come from the gods. We have to protect it. So they were thinking, well, how are we going to protect it from thieves? So they got the best artists of the land to make copies. And there was one artist who managed to make 11 copies that were so exact that you couldn't tell the original anymore. And so as a result, now we have 12 shields to protect. And so then they talk about the 12 sacred shields from then on, which I think is really interesting in terms of sort of authenticity and yeah, how we ascribe meaning and so forth to objects. Because imagine, I talked about the Parthenon before. So currently it's very controversial because a lot of the sculptures from the Parthenon are in lots of museums around the world, but most of them are in London, in the British Museum. So could a solution be to make copies so exact that you can't tell them apart anymore from the originals, and then give each of these museums a copy, right? Then we'll never know. I think that's a really interesting perspective, right? And it comes actually from this text from 2,000 years ago. So now we have the technology, though. So
what you're saying is that Anders copied his work, if I understand that correctly.
Well, I think that's probably a very accurate assessment, because Anders, I think, was profoundly interested in the classical world as it was being taught in 1920s and 30s and 40s, you know, kind of intellectual culture. And yeah, that's an awesome anecdote. I love it. It's fantastic. Thank you.
And with this, we have arrived at the end of our bonus feature. Unpacking the Real is a collaborative research project created by Chris Muller and Helen Wolfenden from Macquarie University and Ben Nicol from the University of Sydney. Remember to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if there's something that's not real enough or too real that you'd like to see featured on the pod, please get in touch with us at realisnotenough@gmail.com. We're grateful for the support of the many organisations who've got behind this project. You can find out more at the Goethe website, For Real Is Not Real Enough. Check the link in the show notes.